I'm a model train enthusiast.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, I've got a whole layout in my basement. It's very much a big passion for me.
Yeah, thank God for model trains.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, if they didn't have the model train, they wouldn't have gotten the idea for the big trains.
TBTL!
I came here to do two things. Eat eggs and nothing. And I'm not out of either.
He's a hot tomato.
Well, you know, if you could say that. I mean, I think he... I don't know what a hot tomato is.
Do you have any idea who I am? I'm a verified Yelp complainer.
Is there, and I'm just guessing here, some kind of medication that you maybe need a lot of and have taken none of, or maybe too much of today?
And, right on, you midnight cowboy. That's not a thing.
All right, hello, good morning, and welcome, everybody, to a Wednesday edition of TBTL, the show that just might be too beautiful to live.
Get on the magic carpet and ride.
My name is Luke Burbank. I am your host.
I got one kidney, one lung, a half a liver, and a pure heart.
Coming to you from the Burbank Springs Broadcast Center, perched atop Alabama Hill, in Bellingham, Washington, the Bay City, where jalapeno... You're going to have sunshine today.
California got sunshine.
Shaping up to be a beautiful day, looking out over Lake Whatcom and Squalicum Mountain. Some of the longest days of the year here in the Pacific Northwest. We're already at the point. It's near the, I guess it would be the, is it called the summer solstice as well? Or is that... We talked about equinox a lot a few months ago on the show. That's when the days are equal, like equal amount of light and darkness. Anyway, we're in that mode where it's light until almost like 10 p.m. It's wonderful. It's great. But the problem is once we hit that peak, then it's all downhill from there. That's okay. Let's keep it positive here on episode 3186 in a collector series.
Let the fun begin.
Some new research out that sales of processed food, salty snacks, sweet things like that, have been skyrocketing during the pandemic.
Of course, you can't go wrong with some sour cream and onion so long as you bring ridged chips.
Basically, it looks like all of the talk that people sort of do about, myself included, by the way, about eating healthy and about trying to, you know, eat unprocessed whole foods. You throw a global pandemic on the mix and we are beelining it for the Oreos. Beelining it. So we'll get into that. Also, my friend Andrew Walsh, it turns out, is not antisocial, as we've all assumed. He is, in fact, very, very smart.
Smarty pants dance, smarty pants dance.
According to some research out that finds that people who don't want to hang out with other people are actually usually smart. So we will get into that, plus emails and V-mails. Of course, the aforementioned Andrew Walsh, longest-running Cobra of the show, known for his drawings of tall ships. He's doing the work. He's baby-stepping. He is Andrew.
Ooh.
Walsh, and he's joining me right now from the Roosevelt neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Good morning, my friend.
Good morning, Luke. I'm trying to think, who did the... you know that loners are smart, because who's the quote attributed, hell is other people? Is that Sartre? Or I don't even know if I'm saying his name right.
I think you're saying the name right. I don't know if I can attribute that to him. It's one of those guys.
Yeah, it's one of those smarty pants loners.
If I guess smarty pants dance, smarty pants dance. If I guess at it, I'll definitely get it wrong.
Yeah.
And then I'll do that. I'll run right out into a crowd of people and start socializing because I am not smart.
Everybody will like, look, it's one of us. Somebody talk to him. Get his number.
Hey, speaking of socializing, okay. I go out for my little jog this morning. And I have my, Apple Watch on, and it's just buzzing and hapticking and alerting. And it's like, I can't actually see the messages because the primary thing on the screen is like the fitness app tracking my very, very slow jog. So I'm kind of a little concerned because I'm like, I hope everything is okay. I've never gotten this many alerts during this period of time at this time in the morning. And then I get back home and I look at the watch. And remember the other day I was talking about how there are random apps that I rarely use that for whatever reason are pushing to my watch. And one of them is apparently WhatsApp. I say, what's up, Andrew? It's you and our friend Bean Baxter, formerly of the Kevin and Bean Show, now a British radio and podcast presenter, going back and forth on WhatsApp. I still haven't even looked at all the messages. Is everything okay? What were you guys talking about?
I still don't know WhatsApp. I kept asking him, WhatsApp. No, he and
I say, what's up, though?
I got self. It's like one of those things where it's no different than text messaging, too.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people can associate with this. Somebody will kind of text two or more people at once, but then clearly only two people are engaging in the conversation. I always feel like I'm having a private conversation in a public room, and I always want to say, well, clearly we're the only ones who are talking here. Let's move this conversation just to you and me, right? Would you like to come into a private chat with me is how I often say it. And then people often say no, and they just do not want to have a private chat with me at all. But, yeah, so Bean Baxter this morning, of course, there's a time difference. So I woke up today to see that Bean had texted us via WhatsApp from his quarantined home in London around 6:30 a.m. our time. So I woke up around 7, and I saw that he had created a group called TBTL, where it's you, me, and him in there. And,
I see. I thought you had a TBTL account or something. All I saw was Bean talking to someone I thought was called TBTL. That was you.
Yeah, I don't know much about WhatsApp. I downloaded it for our Australia trip because we couldn't rely on cell service. And so it's just like the only people I talk to on it are Bean, who's in England, and Broadcast Barry, who's in Seattle. But for some
just
reason,
randomly uses WhatsApp.
Yeah, but he uses WhatsApp. I think as he travels a lot, and also he was trying to, be off his phone more.
Well,
and
it's the preferred app of people who park indiscriminately. People like
is that
me
true?
And
because
Barry.
It sounds like you don't use it. Anyway, so Bean texted in via WhatsApp this morning just to see how he created a group called TBTL. It includes you, me, and him, which is a little presumptuous on his part because apparently he thinks he's part of TBTL now. And he just wanted to make sure that we are okay after hearing the news of the layoffs at American Public Media yesterday. We are okay. Thank you again, listeners. But he just wanted to check in. And then I'm like, yeah, we're good. Thanks to the listeners. I think I actually even said that. And then we started going back and forth. How's London? He had contracted.
Talking about the Thames River. Rick Astley comes up. Taylor Swift makes an appearance in this text chain.
Bean had contracted COVID. I believe he had tweeted out about that. So I was asking him about that. But again, you know, it's morning time. This text is going back and forth for maybe the course of 20 minutes or more casually. But I realize that you're not part of it. And I'm kind of thinking, well, hopefully this is just one of those apps that Luke doesn't know how to log into and he's not seeing these things. Or on
like
the other
my
hand,
work email.
Yeah. Or it's just buzzing like crazy and it's driving you crazy. And in which case, like Bean and I could have taken this into a more private chamber. But again, I need to work on my phrasing. Yes. But anyway, sorry if that was driving you crazy.
No, it actually didn't. It didn't bother me. And I was relieved when I looked at it to see that it was just you and our friend chatting as opposed to somebody furiously trying to get in touch with me because there had been some kind of an emergency.
Can I say something about that, though? Like, it's interesting. Yeah. So you were concerned, but not concerned enough to pause for a second. I'm not even saying that to bust your chops. I'm thinking that might just actually be maybe boundaries. Like, you're thinking, yeah, this could be bad, but it's maybe, like, work bad, right? Like, somebody on one of your jobs is trying to contact you to change something in a script, and they're freaking out, and you just need to say, I will get to this when I'm done with my jog. Is that the kind of vibe?
Yes, it's very sad in a way. I'm not some elite athlete, right? But it's sad how much I don't want to stop running because I want to try to stay at my certain little pace. Mm-hmm. Or I mentioned on the show a few weeks ago, for whatever reason, even though the route I run is the exact same distance, it never varies now, sometimes my watch will randomly think I'm like a 3/10 of a mile short of my goal. So then I have to run around the house until I hit. There's like some kind of OCD-ish things around it for me that are totally dumb. And also, my watch is a phone, so I felt like if it
all
was
right, Maxwell,
Addy,
smart.
If it was Addy or Carrie, I used to have a running shoe phone, but that was a major bitch to answer during the jog.
It was terrible.
99. But if somebody calls me, like if the watch started ringing, and I looked down and I saw it was you or Carrie or Addy or anybody else, really, on a relatively short list, I would stop and answer the phone. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because a call is like next level. But I just thought, you're right. I probably thought it was some work thing that could probably wait 24 more minutes or something like that. But I really wasn't bothered by it. But I was, it was sweet of Bean to reach out. We had, you know, our friend, I think we can say this, our buddy Chris Hayes was like, said something like, because, you know, it's been written about a lot, the layoffs and shows being ended and things happening at the home office. Chris had seen an article about big cuts at American Public Media and said his heart stopped beating. He was like, you know, kind of freaked out for us. A lot of people have reached out, which is very nice. I guess I'm in a way a little bit surprised that the news has been this big, but I mean, I guess, you know, it's a national broadcast outfit. And, you know, some of the shows, particularly like Live From Here and John's show, Hilarious World of Depression, those were popular shows. Yeah. So I guess it follows that people would it would make it onto a lot of people's radar. And then it's also interesting how many people assume, I don't mean this in a bad way, but are rightfully assume that at any point we could have the rug pulled out from under us.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think also like people just hear public radio. I mean, first of all, it's big news in our universe, so a lot of people are reaching out to us because they associate us with it. But, I mean, you're right. It does reach across the pond. Oh, I love saying that. I'm smart, mm-hmm. like Sartre. But
Smartra.
I'm Smartra. What is that?
Hey, Gorgel. Set up some Smartra quotes.
Actually, do you remember there's a Simpsons crossover episode with the critic? We talk about it all the time with John Lovitz's critic character. It's one of my favorite episodes.
I only know because you've reminded me of that, which,
like,
by the way,
a
sounds
show.
Wonderful to me.
And I know that Homer at one point is, I don't know, the critic says something smart or quotes some philosopher, and then Homer just says, oh, I think the critic says Camus can do, but Sartre was smarter. And then Homer says, well, Camus can do. I can't even remember. I'm totally destroying it. I used to have that one line memorized. It used to go through my head like an earworm, and here I am fumbling around for it. But
by the way, you were right that it's Sartre.
Oh, who says hell is other people? Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Now I want to find that. Was it Homer Simpson who said, never start a quote you don't know the end to? Anyway, so yeah, it's big news, but also it's amplified because we're associated with it. So then it bounces back on us a lot. So, but also just generally speaking, I mean, people revere public radio as well they should. And it happened at American Public Media yesterday. Also, there were cuts at WBEZ in Chicago. You told me this morning that there were some pretty big cuts at WBUR Boston, which is close to my heart. So,
yeah, only
I
a
mean,
game
it's
is
really tough.
Only a game is all done. That was the public radio sports show that was one of the very first shows that ever let me do stories. I used to do occasional stories for them about the before there was the WNBA, there was something called the ABL, and Seattle had a team called the Seattle Reign, spelled R-E-I-G-N, the Seattle Reign. Mm-hmm. And they had, I believe Sue Bird was one of their players. Sue Bird, who's gone on to be a very well-respected professor at the University of Washington. It's like, Kate Starbird. But you can see how I would mix those names up.
Sure, yeah.
Both
yeah.
Seattle-associated basketball players. Kate Starbird was a big star at Stanford and played, I believe, for the Seattle Reign. And then went on to, I just randomly saw some quote attributed to her. Had no idea. She's been a professor at the UW for years. I mean, talk about living a life. Anyway, all I'm trying to say is, yeah, man, it's a tough time in the media and it's a tough time in public media right now. And we said this a bunch yesterday, but I just can't repeat it enough. Thank you, everybody who donated to TBTL. Thank you, everybody who's helping us do this, because that's the only thing that's insulating us from, you know, the financial reality that's hitting a lot of other folks that do stuff like what we do, is just that we're so lucky to have the tens.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were even saying last week, like I told you that I always have this instinct, and I think it goes back to my younger days in radio where you were just, I think there's more of an expectation for you to be always looking at what jobs are out there and ready to move. You know, like, why are you laughing? What's that?
Did they close? This is kind of dark, but Did Minnesota Public Radio decide to put a hiring freeze on your morning edition job?
The morning edition job. Well, I think it's a critical role, so I don't know, and I have not applied for it. But that is why it came up. I saw that, and I still there's a part of my brain that says, "Oh, morning edition producer job. Yeah, I should maybe throw my hat in the ring." It's like, wait, what? No, that's in a different state, and I have the best job of my life. Like, what are you doing? But there's still just part of my brain that sees those things and instinctively thinks, yeah, I should put a cassette tape in the mail, send it to him, send him my sizzle reel. But anyway, but it's true. Like, if anything had happened to us, it's hard. Again, I don't want to be dark here, but it's hard not to think about, well, what if it had been us yesterday? Like, what would my recourse be? Because with public radio stations, you know, unfortunately purging jobs like this because of the, and this stuff is all comes back to the economic downturn that's related to COVID. And it's just like, there's not a lot of recourse. And of course, people are feeling that in industries, you know, all across the country. It's not just public radio, but obviously it does hit close to home, and it makes you
I think what we makes you think. The one thing we can't agree on is when they do start hiring radio hosts again, we should definitely get some white males on the air.
That's true, too. Yes,
we should try to place as many white straight men behind the microphone as possible.
It's a perspective.
I honestly think, and I hope people take this in the spirit it's intended, I think the time of that being, at least in public radio, the time of that being a thing that happens a lot. Let me put it this way. If I had a public radio station and there was a hosting position opened, I would do everything in my power humanly possible to not give it to a white male. And I mean that genuinely. Like, there's enough people like you and me that have been talking into microphones since the dawn of the microphone. That being said, we're pretty lucky we have this job, because I think if we were going out and applying for a job right now, we would rightfully be fairly low on the list of people whose voices would need to be heard.
Yeah, and this might sound a little pandering, but I promise I don't mean it to be. These are thoughts that I have anyway. But, you know, when we're on our Zoom calls in our departmental meetings, I like the fact that our department is mostly led by women. A lot of our colleagues are women. It's not just a big chain of white guys all the way up.
This is going to sound like I'm trying to pat myself on the back, but I'm clearly in a lot of ways much more comfortable working with women than men. And I'm not saying that to be congratulatory. I'm not conscious of it, but like Livewire, when we're on a call, like we're going to be doing the show a little bit later today, and our executive producer, Laura Haddon, is a woman. Our editor, Melanie Sevchenko. Our technical director is Molly Pettit. It's actually kind of funny because, you know, obviously my co-host is Elena. And we just hired a new executive director to the business side, a woman named Heather from L.A., who's been working with the Groundlings down there. So other than Tim Harkins, our operations manager, I'm the only other, male on the staff. Whenever I find a therapist, it's always a woman. I'm not that comfortable having a male therapist. I don't know if it's because I was raised with four sisters. I'm not sure what it is about that, but I think I've always been more, and again, I hope this doesn't sound like I'm trying to say that I'm woke or somehow, I don't have a patriarchal bone in my body, because I'm sure that I do. But I commonly find myself in situations where I'm mostly working with women, and that's how I kind of like it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily your or my decision. Like, we just find ourselves here. And I think maybe that's a bit of a testament to public radio. Although I feel a little bit disingenuous. I mean, honestly, if you want to look at American public media, I'm not trying to throw the company under the bus, obviously.
Not the time, Andrew.
I'm very grateful to have a
not
job.
Not the time, as but we still have jobs.
I did say something like, you know, it's cool when we have our meetings, and I realize, our department is run by, you know, very accomplished women who I respect a lot. And then I said, it's not men all the way up. Actually, though, you do get up to a level in American public media. And if I'm being transparent about it, it is all white men all the way up. So that is something. But I hope that the culture kind of continues to change as people think the thoughts that started this conversation that I'm mostly embarrassed about right now, which was you saying, like, maybe we should just make sure to prioritize hiring people who don't all look like us and have all the same worldview that we have.
I don't think we need to tell the listeners, particularly our listeners who are female. Wait, is that – I'm not supposed to use female?
You can say that somebody is male or female, but don't call somebody a male or female, I guess, unless you're a police officer. The female was
suspect.
Apprehended.
Well, I feel like – is women loaded? Like, what's the right term? So what I was going to say is this is not news. What I was trying to say is this is not news to our listeners who are women. But then really where my brain went was, is that Is that now the wrong way? And I'm not doing one of those, you can't say anything anymore. I'm doing one of those, you have to, you know, J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter writer, was in a, you know, internet sort of battle with people because she was upset that there was some terminology being used by some group that was people who menstruate, as opposed to calling them women, because, of course, there could be people who menstruate who don't identify as female, but that really upset her. And I don't understand why she cares. It's just like, you have $1 billion.
That's the thing.
Write another Harry Potter book. Like, and call yourself a woman. My thought on that was, no one's saying you can't call yourself a woman. Exactly. Like, she was just like, if you do this, they surgically remove my sex parts. It's like, I don't think that's how any of this works. But anyway, but that kind of stuff, honestly, what you just heard me do with trying to say female was trying to figure out how I can recognize that what I'm about to say is not news to our listeners who are women, but then I was also trying to remember if that's the way to describe a group of people anymore, and I really mean that.
But what were we going to say, though, to finish your thought about what won't be news to them? Oh, just everything that we've said is not news.
No, that. Right. So I was talking about how LiveWire is, you know, very mostly, the staff is mostly women, and it's funny because our technical director is like this incredibly gifted and talented person named Molly Pettit. And she's like the best person at her job I've ever worked with who does that kind of job. And I've worked with a lot of people who do that work. Sets up all the microphones for the live shows and now is like the Zoom master of all time of getting people to record themselves in person and walking them through it and like then mixing the show later. Like it's just she's really incredible at it. But what's been funny to me is how There has been more than one person that I have reached out to because maybe they're someone who's quasi-famous and I just kind of know them. Like I have them in my phone, and so they'll be like, hey, can you text so-and-so? And as we've been talking, and when I say, okay, the next person you're going to hear from is our technical director, every single person I've said that to has assumed it's a guy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, they'll, and you know, no discredit to any of these people. They're all nice people. We generally don't bring people on LiveWire. We don't bring a lot of Sean Hannity's on the show. So, I mean, they're all people who probably would identify as pretty woke. But it has happened enough that I told Molly about it. And she was like, oh, yeah, that's pretty common. It's like everyone has assumed that she is a man because her job is technical director.
And
not everyone, but a lot of people.
This is a real bonkers example. I don't have science to back me up here, but anecdotally, and I believe I've said this on the show before, but it has been my experience that when people are talking about a cat that they're not very familiar with, if they're meeting a cat for the first time, or if they ask you about your cat, they say, what's her name? There's something feminine that people kind of put on cats. And so I feel like most people assume cats are girls until you name them Professor. We have a cat named Professor Bananas, and whenever I tell somebody about Professor Bananas and they're unfamiliar, they say, oh, why did you name him that, or something along those lines. And I swear to God, I know that I'm talking about a ridiculous name of a tiny little kitty, and it doesn't make any difference, but I swear people assume that Professor Bananas is a boy cat because her name is Professor.
You know what? This is the first I'm learning Professor Bananas is not a boy cat.
No, that's not true.
It's very true. Or if I knew, I forgot. I mean, no offense, but just like the gender of your animals is not like, nor should it be for anyone. Like when people misgender Rudy, I'm always like, the point you're making is interesting, and it's about the question of professor and what that connotes for people. And I'm taking it in a less interesting direction, which is when people think that Rudy is a boy, it mildly miffs me, but it also does not matter. And so it's like, do I take the time to correct them about the gender of this dog they'll never see again, or let it go? But back to your point.
Wait, can I ask you a quick question, though? Is that after you tell them Rudy's name? Because I will say, I mean, especially with pets, names are an indicator. Professor shouldn't be. That's just an honorary title. Rudy is. I mean, there might be women named Rudy, and I don't know of it, but traditionally is
Rudy
a male
from
name.
The Cosby Show.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. Huh.
But that's like the one female Rudy that I could think of. What it is that I'm sure the name plays a big role in it, but it's like people that I know, like my mom can never remember that Rudy is a girl.
Oh, I see.
My mom will always say he, and it's like, who cares? And then one of my siblings will correct her or whatever. Or like people that I've known for a long time and that kind of have been over and like met the dog whenever they talk about the dog, they will start by saying he. And it's because we gave her a boy name. And because I do think she's the kind of dog that, like, for some reason looks like a male dog. Like, just, I don't know why. Yellow Labs just all, they can't all be male. That's not how procreation works. Mm-hmm. But they just seem like a male dog to people. But again, that's to the side of your point about the professor. And I'm not kidding. And I'm not trying. I hope that didn't sound cutting when I said the gender of your pets is not something that I spend a ton of time thinking about. But honestly, if you would have just like asked me off the cuff this morning, what gender is Professor Bananas? I would have said male. And it's probably because of the name Professor.
Oh, that only surprises me because I feel like I talk about the cats and I must say he and she, but maybe I don't. Maybe I just always say their names. Theo.
Right. Theo is a boy, obviously, with the name Theo, right?
Theodore Murray Walsh. That's right. He's a boy. Yeah.
I think we can all agree on one thing, though.
Yeah, well, Scooby-Doo can doo-doo, but Jimmy Carter is smarter.
But Jimmy Carter is smarter.
Scooby-Doo can doo-doo, but Jimmy Carter is smarter.
Thank you. Oh, man, I'm so embarrassed that I brought that up and I didn't even know the joke. I knew everything except for the goddamn joke. Ugh.
I do that so much, though, on this show, like, or a movie that I want to talk about, and then I can't remember any of the details. And I'm just like, why did I bring that up if I could not,
well,
I could not deliver on any of the deets?
At least you do that, it sounds like, in your personal life. I don't feel like you do that on the show, the job that you're being paid to do, talking to microphones, supposedly being somewhat informative and entertaining.
Look, we're just lucky to have this job right now, let's be honest. And with the criticism you've been lobbing at the upper management of APM, I don't know how much longer we'll have it, but let's just try to treasure every minute together. Maybe we can WhatsApp Bean for some job recommendations.
I think I just did the snort. Gotta stop doing
that. All right, we gotta take a quick break, but then when we come back, we'll talk about Oreo sales. Also, I want to play this tape that the parent company of Oreo has put out, Andrew. It's a videotape. Well, it's a YouTube. How old am I? It's a film reel they've put out. The company that owns Oreo and a bunch of other, you know, like junk food products, they've put out this YouTube video about mindful snacking, which I swear to God, it must have just been that, like, you know, the CDC or whoever handles, you know, the sort of like the idea that eating a bag of Oreos a day would not be good for one's blood sugar. It's like somebody just came to them and said, you've got to do something. And they were like, how about a video that's been viewed 1,000 times? Anyway, we'll talk about that and how smart Andrew is coming up on TBTL.
Hello and welcome to Top Story.
All right, our top story by way of the... I think this was the New York Times. Let me actually go. This is one of the few. Yeah, it was one of the few times I didn't print this out, Andrew. So let's all just cross our fingers I can get through this. And I can't because, of course, this particular web browser, this always happens to me. One of my web browsers does not know that I pay the New York Times money every month. And so it's firewalling me out. But now I've hacked into the mainframe. The headline is, has pandemic snacking lured us back to big food and bad habits? An article by Michael Moss. During a spring conference call, the maker of Oreos and other iconic snacks shared some exciting news with Wall Street analysts. In the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, cookie and cracker sales shot up by nearly 30%, which is a gargantuan leap in the world of groceries, Michael Moss writes. Check this out. Sales of I think it was maybe a Campbell's soup was up. Not that Campbell's soup is necessarily junk food, but sales of Campbell's soup was up 90%, Andrew, when the COVID started. And it's still up like 40%, even as things have kind of calmed down a little bit. Soup buying does make some amount of sense. We bought a bunch of soup. It's just you're like, well, that seems like a thing that'll keep. And if we can't get more food, I don't know. There's something comforting about the idea of soup.
Well, I think it's literally a bunker mentality. Like, I found that anything that was in cans, like beans, too, like any people see cans of soup, cans of beans, bags of rice. These are the types of things when people think the world is ending. I need a bunch of this for my bunker. I'm going to put cans of soup, cans of beans and rice. I couldn't find any of that stuff at the grocery store when this stuff first hit.
Yeah, you're totally right. But what's interesting in this article to me is that basically what the evidence tends to bear out, whether it's Campbell's soup or Oreos or, you know, other sort of salty or sweet, delicious, highly processed foods, the sales of all of that stuff appears to be way up. And even weird things like Fig Newtons.
Ugh,
more than 40% of the soaring sales in Fig Newtons and Nutter Butter cookies came from first-time buyers. So there was apparently a bunch of people who, in the freakout, were like, let me try Fig Newtons for the first time. That's an interesting stat to me.
Yeah, first time, long time, first time. That surprises me because Fig Newtons, that actually sounds really nice to me and comforting and giving me kind of that, boy, I'm hearing notes of disgust coming down the line.
We'll get into Fig Newtons in a moment.
Accidentally a fly flew in your mouth or something, but I like Fig Newtons. Speaking of flies, are those flies in Fig Newtons? No, they're figs. But for me, like...
It's fruit and cake, I believe the ads used to say.
If I were to have one now for the first time, I don't know if I'd necessarily like it, but it certainly takes me back to a time, and it seems very comforting. I could tuck into some Fig Newtons right now. Of course, my family also, you'll be against this, even if you hate Fig Newtons. I feel like you're a traditionalist when it comes to things like Oreos. Like, you don't go in for double stuff. My family was a double stuff family. And also for Fig Newtons, we started buying the ones that had different kinds of filling, like raspberry, I believe, and blueberry filling.
Well, this is the thing that's so funny. I think of Fig Newtons as being kind of like you heard the sound of disgust in my voice. And yet, I don't actually find a Fig Newton an unpleasant taste. It's just like a sweet jam kind of thing that's, you know, in a sort of cake-like surrounding. Like, it's not a bad taste. It's not, you know, peace and love to our listeners in Australia. It's not Vegemite, something that's, like, aggressive if you haven't tasted it before. It's not durian, something that you have to really acclimate to as a flavor. Like, it's not an unpleasant flavor. I think it was just because if I was going to get to eat like a cookie as a kid, a Fig Newton seemed like such a letdown to me compared to, for instance, an Oreo. Hey, I just wanted to see if I remember this right, though. Remember how the Fig Newton ads were always like trying to explain what a Fig Newton is in the 80s?
I don't remember. Do you have something dialed up there?
Do you remember this?
Never. I thought I said no eating cookies in bed.
It's not a cookie, Mother. It's a fruit Newton.
Oh, carry on then, carry on.
A cookie is just a cookie, but Newtons are fruit and cake.
Do you remember those ads?
Oh, God, I totally do. Yes, you're right. It is a little explanatory there at the end, isn't it?
Yeah, because I think, I mean, again, maybe it's just the household I grew up in, but just Fig Newtons did not seem like, again, we didn't get to eat as much. As I got older... And I don't know if this was maybe just like food cost dropping. Like, I don't think we ate pretty healthy when I was a little kid. Part of it was because my parents had probably only recently migrated off of the commune. So there's probably a lot of residual hippiness. Mm. But also, I think it just had to do with my mom never wanted to buy food that she thought was expensive. And oddly enough, you know, stuff like cookies and chips and stuff seemed expensive to her, even though now it's sort of the opposite problem. That tends to be the food that is high in calories and is very cheap, and so people can afford it. It seemed like the opposite when I was a kid. We ate a lot of stuff that I thought was gross because it was like the stuff that was more affordable. But so if we were going to get to have cookies, I was going to be bummed if it was fruit and cake instead of like an Oreo or a Chips Ahoy or something like that. But, I mean, back to this New York Times story, the evidence seems to be that when we're stressed out, we are all going back to eating heavily processed food, including people in the younger demo who, like, that would, I'm not sure the exact bracket of it, but let's just say people between, like, say, 18 and 25, who actually do generally identify as healthier eaters and who are more suspicious of big food. In fact, one of the executives from one of these giant, you know, food conglomerates actually was on a conference call a while ago and said, look, we've got an issue, which is that younger people don't trust the food that we make because we're these big giant corporations and we're heavily processing this stuff. Even some of those young people are going to – they're the people that are trying Fruit Newtons for the first time or whatever. Mm. Like, it's even getting to people who are, you know, younger and generally would eat healthier. They're just like, you know what? I need some ridged chips right now for my soul.
Yeah, I also wonder, is there a chance that the first-time Newton buyers were playing in that space because all of the other cookies were sold out?
Maybe. Because the other one, that Sword and first-time users, Nutter Butters, which I've always found to be mildly weird. Now, I do, again, I like the flavor of a Nutter Butter. It's like a peanut butter-flavored cookie, and I believe the outside of the cookie itself is shaped like a peanut, right? Do I remember
right? Yeah, it's a little sandwich cookie, I believe, kind of like an Oreo style, only the cream is a peanut cream, and they are peanut buttery, but also they're sweet enough. Like, I don't like something if it's going to be too dry and not sweet in my cookies, if that makes sense. But I do like a Nutter Butter, and I love the fact that it's shaped like the food it's representing. I think more things should be like that. We've talked on the show before about, like, there are whole threads on Reddit of restaurants that are shaped like the thing they serve, you know, like taco stands that are shaped like tacos, or hot dog stands that are shaped like hot dogs. Ice cream is a huge one. I love that stuff.
Yeah. You were talking before the show about Oreo cereal. There's Oreo cereal.
So you didn't know about that either. You know, we're not a huge cereal family, although I do go through phases and I do like it. I'm very unoriginal, I guess, with my I'm just like, I get three cereals over and over. None of them are really that exciting. Like, Cheerios is my go-to.
Really?
Because I'm a cartoon character. Yeah, like, that's what I actually had Cheerios for breakfast today. Like, that's my number one go-to cereal. Crispix is number two because we had it growing up. And actually, it's mostly those two. I guess if they don't have Crispix, I'll take a Life cereal. But anyway, very, very pedestrian, bland.
You got to eat Life fast, though, right?
Yeah, it gets real soggy. There might be some others in there, too, but those are my main cereal things. Anyway, I have been buying more cereal lately, and I was in the aisle. Oh, I know what it was. Genevieve. I think I can say this. Genevieve, speaking of comfort foods, had asked me to pick up some Cocoa Krispies for her. Mm-hmm. And now I rarely buy that. So I'm looking around the sugar cereal area, and I saw that there's a box of Oreo cookies cereal, which is ridiculous. I know that you've said before, like, Cookie Crisp, like, it was right there in the name. We were just giving kids dessert for breakfast. Somehow the fact that there was just a generic branding, though, like Cookie Crisp, okay, kids like cookies. But this is like, oh, no, here's Oreo cookies for breakfast. And so I took a photo of it.
It's like Haagen-Dazs ice cream cereal. Like, what?
Yeah, right. Wait. Yeah. And so I take a photo of it, and I send it to Genevieve, and I'm like, I guess we're not even pretending anymore. Like, here's a box of Oreo cereal. And she wrote back, yes, also, terrible name. Do you know what they're called?
What?
Oreo O's.
No.
Swear to God. Look it up.
Terrible.
Oreo O's? What? Just Oreos.
Exactly. It's sitting right there. You separate the O at the beginning out. O. Rios.
Oh, no.
Right?
I'm sorry. No. Now we're going to fight about this. No. I think you separate the second O out. Oreos.
Okay. I can see the argument for that. Let me put it this way. Oreos, as you're saying, or O-Rios are both vastly superior to Oreo O's. What is that, the name of a Grateful Dead record?
Right. So it's a clip of me stuttering my way through a conversation on the show.
That's terrible. That's a terrible name. That's what the ad wizards came up with.
I know. Isn't it really bad? It's almost shockingly bad. I feel like it's a prank.
I am so weird with my food stuff. Like, every time we talk about cereal, I mention this, but it's like, I loved cereal as a kid. We didn't really get sugar cereal, but even so, I mean, we would get stuff that was, I mean, famously, and as I've talked about so many times, we would get chocolate milk for some reason. I would put chocolate milk in regular Rice Krispies. So that kind of made it like Cocoa Krispies, but inverted. It was like a deconstructed Cocoa Krispies.
I've never done that. Wow.
Or I'd put it in Kix. We got Kix a lot because Kix was offered through the WIC program, you know, which
really?
Is like where you get.
Because it rhymes?
Kix was. If it rhymes, it shines. Because basically if you got WIC, which was Women, Infant, and Children, it's like basically whenever my mom would have a baby, which was all the time, for a certain amount of time while the child is still young, if you are under a certain income level, you're eligible for getting like milk, cheese, and cereal. You know, it's food stamps essentially. But it was like, it's so weird. It was like the food stamps my dad was okay with us getting, or maybe my mom was doing it on the sly. My dad was very like, we can pay for our own things. We don't, you know. And but anyway, there was a lot of rules around that. You couldn't get Cocoa Puffs or, you know, Kooky Crisp. You couldn't get any of that stuff on WIC. And so, but you could get chocolate milk for some reason. So I would, you know, put chocolate milk in the cereal and then make the healthy cereal less healthy. But I actually still love Kix. I guess where I'm trying to go with this is I love cereal so much I never eat it. And I don't know why, because I eat, particularly during quarantine. Like, by the way, this article in the New York Times exactly describes me. I have never eaten worse in my life in terms of the amount of processed food that I'm taking in on a daily basis. I mean, I was fairly disciplined in the before times, or somewhat disciplined, and that's just out the window now. And yet for some reason I will never like buy a box of cereal and just like let myself have a bowl of cereal at 4 p.m. or 9 o'clock at night. But then I will eat sometimes two pizzas in the same day. It's like, it's so inconsistent with me. I don't know why my brain categorizes certain foods as being off limits, but then other foods it's fine with.
Yeah, I've been, there's something, I talk a lot on the show about how it becomes nighttime. I've been up, Genevieve's asleep, it's like midnight, then I lose all self-control and I'll start pounding cookies if they're in the house or something like that, which is why I don't like to have cookies in the house, because if they're not there, I'm fine with it, right? I'll literally eat an orange and I'm just as happy. But the thing is, I think I usually feel more guilt around it or shame. And lately, I just, the shame has gone out the window. I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to eat a, Luke said I lost weight last week. I'm going to eat 50 of these cookies right now. And now, here's one thing I've been doing. I've never baked anything in my life as far as like a dessert or anything is concerned. It's just not something I've ever really learned to do. And while I didn't grow up learning how to cook, you know, main courses and foods like that, I had a desire to eat those things, so I've learned how to cook. But I'm not a big sweet tooth person, so if I don't have cookies in the house, that's fine. I'm not going to make cookies. But Genevieve the other day whipped up like a batch of cookie dough, of just simple chocolate chip cookie dough. And so I asked her, I'm like, can you just tell me, like, how do I make these? Like, just like, because there's a bunch of dough sitting in there. And now it's the perfect puttering thing for me. So like the last two nights I've just been taking her dough and putting it on sheets and like in little dollops and just kind of like trying to figure out exactly the right temperature and exactly the right time and size and everything. And I'm just making tons of cookies, and they don't all fit when you're going to put them away. They don't all fit in the container. And so you have to eat the ones that don't fit in the container. And boy, have I some might say get a bigger container, but I'm using tiny, tiny containers and then eating all the cookies that don't fit.
Any cookie that can't fit in this thimble, I have to eat.
Exactly.
I don't know, a couple weeks ago, randomly, Carrie just made a huge batch of cookies and put them in this like giant Tupperware container. We don't use thimbles around here, Andrew. We use giant Tupperware containers. I don't know how many dozen cookies it was. It seemed like a lot. And it was just, I mean, she must have been bored. And I'll be darned if I didn't go from eating zero cookies a day to eating 12 cookies a day until they were all gone.
Yeah.
And that's how my brain works with sweets too. Like if they're not around, I'm generally fine. I don't crave them. I won't go to great lengths to have them. But if they're around, I will just absolutely punish those cookies. Like I it took me like 4 days to eat all. I don't think Carrie ate one of them, which at that point I was just like, are you trying to fatten me up here for some kind of a ritual that I should be worried about? Like, what is with baking 3 dozen cookies and eating zero of them?
Yes, but and it's also one of the reasons why I still can't find certain things in the stores. To go back to this idea of maybe people are eating Fig Newtons, it's not a cookie. Because everything else is, you know, gone at the store. I've noticed like weird, like the stores are still not fully stocked. Like hand soap, okay, they're bringing some like off-brand hand soap in, but like I've gone to 4 or 5 different stores, including a hardware store that I go to that sells Mrs. Meyer's hand soaps, and nobody has any Mrs. Meyer's. They must just be so backed up production-wise. Okay, so that makes sense, but then you just get to these other things. Like, I noticed that the Asian food section of the store is just, like, getting really empty. I don't know if that's a supply chain thing, and for some reason, like, a lot of those products come from the same brands, and it just looks decimated. I don't know what it is. But there's also, like, this one kind of breadcrumb, panko breadcrumbs, mm-hmm. I think they're pronounced. They're, like, kind of a – you know what they are. I don't have to explain them.
Yeah. And like for tempura, you would use them and things like that.
Yeah, they're close to tempura. Yeah, tempura, actually the tempura box is right next to them usually. But it's very similar, kind of very coarse, light breadcrumbs that you can kind of, I use them on chicken and stuff. Anyway, I know that those are in two different parts of the store. You can find them in the Asian food section of the store and they're in the baking section of the store. For some reason, like there's just no panko breadcrumbs available at the Safeway. I have no idea why. And I'll just see these kind of like, these areas of just desolate aisles here and there, and they kind of change and rotate out, and I can't figure out what's going on with supply chains.
You know what? I decided to make tacos last night. I had them for dinner. It was Taco Tuesday. Hmm. That was a coincidence, by the way. I almost considered not making them because I'd accidentally bought the fixings for tacos on a Tuesday. I will tell you, though, to the non-meat eaters in the audience, that is, for all the things that you can make that have a kind of a fake meat component, ground beef, like there's this product made by a company called Korn, which is like Q-O-R-N. It's called like, you know, meatless grounds or something. You throw that stuff into a pan with taco seasoning, like, and none of this fancy Frontera, you know, slightly moist, fancy business. I'm talking good old-fashioned, you know, McCormick's, just like MSG-laden powder taco seasoning. You throw that in there, you would not know that you're not eating a taco with real ground beef in it. It is completely, like, it does the job. But anyway, what was funny was I bought these, speaking of, can we say ethnic foods or foods that are, you know, identified with a certain region of the world? I went over to I think they call it like the Hispanic food section of the grocery store. And I bought these peppers, these really yummy, like hot peppers. Then I opened them and was eating them and they were delicious and they were great. They had expired in 2018.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, it's fine. It's like those things are, you could eat those in 100 years. I don't think I was in danger, but I thought, it was like best if enjoyed by like some date in 2018. And I was like, how's this still on the counter? What is going on with this? And again, I continued eating them and we'll eat them again today because they're delicious. And they're just literally peppers floating in some kind of, you know, vinegary solution. I mean, they're totally preserved. But I thought, man, someone is not rotating the stock properly.
Yeah, no kidding. And they're refrigerated after opening, I assume?
Now they're refrigerated, but they weren't. You know, they were just like on the out there on the counter. Mm-hmm. Hey, this is the other thing I wanted to play for you. This company, the company that makes Oreos, it's called Mondelez International. I think that they like acquired, maybe it was Kraft or something. The size of these food conglomerates is just, it's just truly shocking. Mm-hmm. I did that story about Halloween candy, about where all the fun-sized candy bars come from. They pretty much all come from this one factory in Chicago, and that's the Mars company. And you start to really like, you start to look at the tentacles of these food companies, and they're just, it's insane because, you know, they just keep getting acquired by larger and larger operations. But anyway, this is a video put out by the people that make Oreos about, I guess, allegedly or how to not eat so many Oreos. I find the woman who does, she's clearly like a mindfulness expert. I find there to be something very uncanny about this whole thing. Can I play you some of this audio,
please,
Andrew?
Please, please.
Okay. Mindful snacking.
Eating your snacks mindfully instead of mindlessly munching can help them become part of your healthy lifestyle.
By the way, this is Dr. Susan Albers, PSYD. I mean, a doctor of psychiatry, maybe? That's who is. She's standing in a kitchen. They did that thing that I find very distracting where they did a two-camera shoot, Andrew, but a lot of the footage they use is from the B-cam, but it's her. She's not looking at it.
Okay, yeah. You don't like that?
You know, that's like
it gives you a kind of a sense of being behind the scenes. We're just sitting on
the set.
The
problem is that this is, God, can I take this to the least interesting and least accessible place? Yes, I can, Andrew.
I'm down with that shot. Did you print it out?
I'm down with that shot if the second camera is very far away from the first camera, or is it a very, like, is it at a 90-degree different angle? Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like the main camera, the person's looking at it, and then the other shot is maybe them from the side. This one is where they have the main camera, and then the B camera is like 2 inches to the right, so it just looks like she's looking at the wrong camera. Like
that actually makes a lot of sense. I don't think that that is a petty complaint. Yeah, because it's also called – this is slightly different, but it's kind of like a jump cut. Like in production, I remember learning the video production. Like you don't want to go to a shot that's like almost exactly the same but slightly off because it just looks like a bad edit. You need to cut away to something very different. And if you're going back and forth between two cameras that are almost next to each other but one is slightly off.
And she's not looking at the slightly off camera. She's looking – she's doing the whole thing to the main camera. So it's just anyway, it's a little weird, but that's not the weirdest part of the video. I just think the whole thing is kind of odd.
Here are six different ways you can make your treat a mindful snacking experience. Think of it as a menu for mindful snacking. Choose two or three of these techniques that appeal to you and apply them when you have a treat. First, portion out your snack. Take it out of the bag or the box and put it on a plate. This way you can give it all of your attention. You don't have to decide as you eat when to stop. You can just enjoy. Minimize distraction. Turn off your phone so that your mind...
She wants you to turn off your phone while you're eating your three Oreos that you've parceled out onto the plate.
Are you sitting cross-legged, by the way, on the floor?
She takes it even further, though.
Is not taken out of the moment while you're eating. You also might want to turn off the TV. My motto is, when you eat, just eat.
Yeah, turn off your TV when it's time to eat your Fritos.
When you're trying to eat your Oreos, too. It's like, what? No, I'm doing this so that I can watch TV.
I feel like if you're trying to eat Oreos and you're not looking at a television, the Oreos start disappearing like Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future. Like they only exist if you're watching TV.
That's right.
What are you talking about? Again, these are, you know, to be honest with you, these are not the worst tips. She goes into great detail about basically chew your food, taste your food, experience your food, finish. She was like, swallow the bite you're working on before you take the next bite, which... maybe part of why this video weirded me out was because I identified a number of behaviors that I do.
Sure.
Like, it is weird. And she even literally says, like, a lot of times we're thinking about the next bite while we're still in the midst of the bite we're on. And I was like, damn.
No,
that's like, that's sort of the metaphor for my life. Like, I should just swallow the cookie, the bite of cookie I'm eating and enjoy that and then have another bite. I'll be taking another bite and I'm not even finished with, you know, the thing I'm in the middle of. So it is weird to me, though, that it's not weird. It's explainable. But it's funny to me that this company that would like you to please consume as much of their product as possible has had to put out this video about mindfulness so that they can claim to the New York Times that they're trying to address the problem of people maybe eating too many Oreos.
Right. And I really don't like – I mean – like you say, I'm guilty of a lot of these behaviors that she's describing. And I don't know when I became a whorfer, but I definitely am. Oh, God, I hear it. God, I hear it. It's going to be used in an intro. But at one point, I think actually it might be tied to a job I had here in Seattle working on a public radio show where our days were really, really full, but we always stopped to grab lunch. And the guy grab lunch with, another guy who worked on the show, was a very fast eater, and we'd like run out to a teriyaki place across the street and then we would just eat our food super fast, and he was a super fast eater. And I think ever since then I've become a really fast eater, especially if nobody's looking, and usually nobody is looking these days because I'm just like, for some reason, hiding in the kitchen eating over the sink and just like slopping things all over the place and just like, I mean, literally, like, I'm thinking about the next four bites. Like, I'm not, I mean, I'm just like, it's, and I almost wonder if it is a quasi disorder that the part of me sometimes, especially in a restaurant or something, I, if they bring out a huge plate of food, you know, everything that I ordered, but it looks like a lot, I think I want to eat it quickly to, like, make the evidence go away. Like, it's a weird thing to admit, but I do think there's part of something in my brain that says, like, eat all of this off this plate because this is an embarrassing amount of food. And if somebody sees an empty plate later, they won't know how much food you just ate. That's not a healthy way of looking at food.
I mean,
anyway.
I can't throw any stones in the, like, bizarre relationship with food department and or weight and or dysmorphia kind of stuff. But it's interesting to me that it might have been something you developed in adult life, because my guess would be a lot of that stuff gets imprinted when we're young and then you just stick with it. Like, the thing I always say about the household I grew up in was there was plenty of food. We were not lacking for food, but there was not enough of the good food, like the food that tasted good. Like, a dinner for us would very commonly be, when I was growing up, it's probably different for the other siblings I have as everybody got older and as there were fewer kids in the house, but it'd be like some nachos, like however many chips were left in the bag, that would be some nachos, and then something out of the freezer that was thawed out, maybe a pork chop or two, and then three Arby's sandwiches that were hanging around for some reason. So for me, it'd be like, oh, I'm zeroing in on that Arby's. And if I ate it really fast, then maybe I could get a second one. So I think that got into my mind. And I inhale food. Like, it is – people would be shocked to see how much food I can eat. I mean, we were playing that tape a while ago of me eating those Dick's cheeseburgers at Cairo. But I can absolutely inhale food. And I mean, probably if I put my mind to it, if I took like a month and I just said, Lord knows I've done plenty of like projects on myself in various ways. But if I just said, for this month, I'm going to actually follow this mindfulness tips from the fast or from the junk food lady, I bet you I could change the pace at which I eat food. And it probably would be good for me, just because A, I would enjoy it more, and B, I'd probably stop when I'm actually full instead of getting as much food into my system as I can before my body figures it out, which is a thing I do sometimes, mm-hmm. which is so weird.
Yeah.
When I'm like, you know, like, why am I trying to trick my body into getting more food than I need in there? That's not 100% healthy.
Yeah, especially when you realize you're doing it. I mean, you're doing it subconsciously. That's one thing. But then when you realize, oh, wait, I'm eating this quickly so that I will be able to have another piece of pizza. And I don't know if you do that in the same moments I do, too, when it's like a weekend. And especially in these times where it's hard to differentiate days or make weekends feel special from other things. We've talked about this. I think having special food delivery on weekend nights is one way we kind of demark the fact that it's a weekend. And so I'll find myself like eating a piece of pizza knowing that if I slow down, I'll be fine. But saying, no, damn it, it's Friday night. I'm going to eat, well, I was going to say half a pizza, which I know you mock because for you it would be a whole pizza. But
mm-hmm. Yes. Well, it depends on where it's from. Depends on the size. I told you that I made I heated up this masala the other night. There was just like a random jar of it in the pantry area. Our laundry room has now been converted into the food bunker. But I made like more rice than I needed. And after I'd had some of the masala, I was like, that's good, but I don't need to do it. I just put some rice in a bowl and then just put butter in there, like, and a little salt. Why am I not eating just rice with butter in it? On like a daily basis. It was so good.
Yeah, that's probably not super healthy though, right?
No. Are you joking?
No, I know. Well, you asked why you're not doing it. I'm like, well, I think there's...
I know, but I'm eating so many other unhealthy things. That's what I'm trying to say with this. Is so... By the way, I got the picture of the Oreo cereal. That looks delicious. It's just so inconsistent with me. It's like... Yeah, I just don't know why. I can't quite figure out why it is that I'm indulging in the ways I'm indulging and when I'm indulging. I just have no the version of my life before the pandemic, I had a lot of food rules, and I may not have always stuck to them, but the rules existed in my mind, and there was like plans, and I'm going to do this on this day, and then I'm going to have this, and now it's just like they're just out the window, it's just haphazard. I saw this article. I've signed up for this service called Pocket, which is of all of the like news article algorithms, it's the one that just has me totally figured out. Like, they regularly suggest articles that are very interesting for me. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. So do you put in like a certain level? Sorry. again, focusing on the least interesting thing, but I really miss my RSS feeds of old. Like, I used to be a big Google Reader person where I could, you know, set up all of my feeds. Everything was RSS-based kind of in the early blog days, and I could just, like, go there and have all of my sources. But I've never been able to find a replacement for that ever since that style of RSS feed went away. So tell me more about this Pocket.
I don't even know how I signed up for it. That's the weird part. It started showing up when I would turn on Firefox, the browser Firefox.
Uh-huh.
It would – I don't know. This is like – I don't know how – maybe it was a virus. Maybe it was a friendly virus. Maybe it was
– That would be
Casper
something.
Casper the friendly virus. Somehow one day when I would turn on or log into or boot up Firefox, it would just be this website called Pocket, getpocket.com. And then I kept noticing these are actually stories that I'm interested in for whatever reason. And then I think I might have like subscribed to it or whatever. But it really does, for me anyway, it's a lot of like kind of social science stories, but it's from, you know, a whole wide range of places. Anyway, this article I saw on Pocket, which was written by Sarah Sloat. I believe it was for some publication maybe called Inverse. Evolution made really smart people long to be loners. Research finds highly intelligent individuals prefer to socialize less than the rest of us. So that's got to be good news for you, Andrew. It was a paper in the British Journal of Psychology. These two researchers found that highly intelligent people experience lower life satisfaction when they socialize with friends more frequently. They call these people the Sherlocks. I guess that would be like a Sherlock Holmes.
I guess so. Was he a loner? I don't really know much about the Sherlock Holmes universe.
Man, I was obsessed with Sherlock Holmes when I was a kid, but I don't even think I was reading the like Arthur Conan Doyle. I might have been reading like sort of like pulpier. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I may have, like, somebody else writing, you know, almost like, not cartoon, but very simplified, like Sherlock Holmes mysteries for kids or something.
Okay.
I remember reading a ton of Sherlock Holmes, but I don't know if I was actually reading the real stuff or something that was written in, like, 1983.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this is how they came to this conclusion, Andrew, that you're very smart. They analyzed the survey responses of 15,000 individuals between the ages of 18 and 28. The data was part of a national longitudinal study of adolescent health. It measured life satisfaction, intelligence, health. The data revealed that being around dense crowds of people typically leads to unhappiness, while socializing with friends typically leads to happiness. That is, unless the person in question is highly intelligent, Andrew.
Go on.
So what they basically – the sort of basic theory is that we as humans are programmed to want to be around other people. This goes back to our sort of like being on the, you know, on the Serengeti or whatever. Like, so being around people kept us safe and was important. But the people who are really smart are evolving faster and actually are more likely to be outliers on things that the rest of us are into, including socialization. Because basically the rest of us, the mouth breathers, the people like me, we want to just hang out with people all the time because we're still in old brain. But Andrew, you and the Sherlocks are in new brain, and that usually corresponds with being highly intelligent.
I don't know much about evolution. I mean, I know that it's against God. But aside mm-hmm. from that, I don't know much about evolution, but that doesn't – how are the – putting me aside for a second – how are the people who are displaying these characteristics of not socializing, how are they evolving faster? By definition, you'd think that the Johnny Good Times like you, Luke, are out there mixing it up and probably having more offspring because of the socializing.
Well, no, we're getting dumber, believe me. I mean, we have definitely flipped natural selection on its head. The people like me are just procreating left and right, and the people like you are... Well, you're building a lot of stuff in Minecraft, but not so much on the physical plane of life.
Oh, here's not just building stuff in Minecraft, then getting blown up. The last three nights of my life, I did get back into Minecraft this weekend, by the way, after our conversation.
What do you mean getting blown up? Someone bombed your Minecraft world?
There's monsters when you... I don't even want to
really?
Get into it. Yeah. It's like you can definitely die, and I keep dying, and I don't know... I don't want to talk about this. It's so stupid.
I'll tell you the research. I mean, this does sound like us. It sounds like I'm listening to a very smart person. I will say that. In general, more intelligent individuals are more likely to have unnatural, in quotes, preferences and values that our ancestors did not. One of the researchers tells Inverse. It is extremely natural for species like humans to seek and desire friendship, and as a result, more intelligent individuals are likely to seek them less. Mm. The survey results revealed that smarter people were less likely to feel that they benefited from friendships, but they actually socialized more than less intelligent people, which seems contradictory to me. Intelligence is believed to have evolved as a psychological mechanism to solve novel problems. The sort of challenges that weren't a regular part of life. For our ancestors, frequent contact with friends and allies was a necessity that allowed them to survive. Being highly intelligent, however, meant an individual was more likely to be able to solve problems without another person's help, which in turn diminished the importance of their friendships.
Hmm. Sound so, this, you know who would have dug this article? Young Andrew. unrelated to young Sheldon. But it is true, like, I am somebody who... You know,
the guy who makes that show was an obsessed TBTL listener, Steve Malero.
Yeah, I don't think he's listening anymore.
No, he stopped years ago.
Yeah. Anyway, I did carry my isolation as a bit of a badge, I think, in my 20s, which is odd, and probably late teens, like, basically my college days, it was my reputation to be like everybody was going out and I would stay in, but still, like, by today's standards, I'm sure I went out a lot, you know, but but I still had the reputation of the guy who was reluctant to go out. I could stay in my shitty little one room apartment and just watch Twin Peaks videos that I rented from the library and, you know, screw the world. And I do think that I like to think that that made me better than everybody else. I do think that I had this weird... It's so funny because I'm not... I mean, I appreciate the compliments and the joking, but I'm not that smart of a person. And
untrue.
I do think, though, I somehow thought of myself as this kind of... You know, I just was a snobby college student who, like, read a bunch of Beats and thought that I was just, like, really, you know... viewing the world through their eyes and being introspective and a loner and a smarty pants who read fucking Vonnegut. Because you have to be real smart to read Vonnegut. Sorry about the language.
Scooby-Doo, can do do. I mean, I think what you were doing is a very natural thing that a lot of us do, which is you were sort of, I don't want to say weaponizing, but you were taking something that was felt necessary to you for survival, which was limiting some of your social interactions because of the amount of anxiety it created for you, but then also turning that into sort of a personality trait or almost a personality quality. Mm-hmm. I think we all do that to some degree to get by. There's some kind of proclivity that we have, and then we sort of memorialize that within our life as our personality so that it makes sense.
I'm just glad. The best thing I ever did was throw away my notebooks from that era, man. I just think
really
about
though.
That.
I
yes,
see.
I still. I mean, I wonder if the day will ever come that I regret that. But it's funny. I held on to those for so many years, and whenever I would talk about this era of my life, there'd be part of my brain that would get anxious because I know that there were just like notebooks upon notebooks upon notebooks of bad poetry and doodles and short stories and all of these things that I would write. And I know they were all terrible and pretentious. And you're taught that you can't throw that stuff away because you don't want to, like, well, it's kind of a conversation we're having in the country right now, right? Hey, you can't, don't hide the past or some sort of weird mentality of like, well, I wrote these things and they were important to me at one point, so therefore the world should always have them. Like, what the hell? No, I never want anybody to see them. And now I can talk about these days and know that I wrote that stuff, but also know that it's completely destroyed and nobody will ever find it. And it is such a sense of relief. I have
Did
a couple of short
stuff?
Stories. No, I just
throw it into the garbage.
I think it was moving out of LA into Seattle, I finally was like, I gotta go through this. So I took one last look at it. It was amazing how much of the stuff I kind of remembered. I mean, a lot of it was in a drug-fueled haze, but there were pages that I would go back to, and so there was stuff that I was well-worn, but I was also just like, I was so happy to have that last moment with it and then throw it away.
That's so interesting. Like, I mean, listen, I was also screwing the world, but in a much more literal way. Was that better? Me just being out in the night drunk at karaoke bars, you know, making trouble, starting fights or hitting on people or whatever. Like, I don't think that that's a... By the way, there might be a middle path. Maybe we're just choosing two extremes here, neither of which is great. But I don't know. It doesn't sound like you describe it so negatively, like the fact that you were figuring out your personality and figuring out the world and the path you took was... I feel like it's a fairly common story that when you start to get a little bit of knowledge about the world and you start to, you know, read some of the classics. I mean, everybody feel. Look, the first time I read Catcher in the Rye, I thought I had discovered the book.
Yeah, like, right. Yeah, yeah.
I remember just thinking, no one's ever understood a book the way I understand this book as a slightly disaffected, you know, 15-year-old or something. Like, I think that's a pretty... I think it's a pretty natural way to respond to that kind of stuff. I don't know. I think I was doing more damage in the world by being out and being careless with people's feelings and just thoughtless in the world than you were at home writing your Sartre knockoff.
Well, I don't think that I was causing harm to the world. And frankly, I don't regret. I don't sit around thinking like, oh, I regret how I spent my time in college. I enjoyed those times. I actually look fondly at what was the beer? There were so many cheap beers I was drinking at the time, but there was one. I know I talk about Red Dog a lot because that was the cheapest beer you get in bottles. But there was something else. I know I was on a High Life Jag for a while, but I have very specific memories of drinking some really cheap beer. And like again, like I'd drive back from the fiberglass factory on like a Friday. I would stop at the Kent Free Library. I would rent the next like three or four video cassettes of Twin Peaks. I would stop at the store and buy my cheap ass beer, and I would just like go home and into my tiny shitty ass little one room apartment and underneath my framed picture of Janine Garofalo and just sequester myself. And I honestly like that doesn't embarrass me that much. That is who I am. And it doesn't even embarrass me that I spent a lot of that time writing this terrible crap. But I'm glad that that terrible crap doesn't exist anymore. I'm glad that no eyes will ever see it. Except I do have some 3.5-inch floppies laying around that I should probably drive a nail through.
Boy, coming home from the fiberglass factory has a real Bukowski feel to it.
And all, of course, and I was reading, and I didn't get that job because I was a Bukowski fan, but I was also reading a lot of Bukowski at the time, a lot of Raymond Carver. And again, like, I have warm feelings.
That's good stuff, though.
Yeah, Raymond I remember Carver. Sitting, oh, Raymond Carver is so good. I mean, Bukowski is a problematic person, no doubt about it, but he's also a really good writer. I also think that I'm a little embarrassed because it is so... You mentioned Catcher in the Rye. Like, it is very stereotypical. I mean, I'm just like, could I be more of a pretentious, like, an unearned pretentious white young man reading my Bukowski and my Raymond Carver and thinking that I've really got a line on the world? Like, that's kind of embarrassing, but it is what it is.
All I can think when I see pictures of Bukowski is how bad do you think his breath was?
I know.
Because all he did was just smoke cigarettes and drink booze and bloviate. Is that how you say that word?
Yeah, it is. Like, you know, like, who I think that about that's much less fair is Willem Dafoe. And I don't know why. It's so unfair.
Because he's the Green Goblin?
Is he? I don't know why. Like, I really like Willem Dafoe, for real. Like, if he comes on the screen, I'm like, I'm into this. But I always think, like, man, you must have terrible breath.
That's hilarious. I would assume Willem Dafoe has minty breath. He seems like a very...
Really?
He was on one of the final episodes of the Dinner Party Download, because when he was in that movie, The Florida Project, and he was so delightful. He definitely seemed like someone with good oral hygiene. Plus, I think he has a big gap in the front. So you know he's able to floss that, keep that clean.
That's true.
With diastema. But it's like because somebody I follow on Twitter is one of these like historical – it's called like History Lovers Club. And they'll just tweet out random photos all the time. And for whatever reason, they must have uncovered a trove of like Bukowski photos. And again, I do think he had his skills as a writer. And when you're a certain kind of young man who has a certain kind of relationship with alcohol, it's a very appealing kind of writing. But I would just randomly see these pictures of him, and it's always just like he's just like surrounded by like cigarette butts and spent bottles, and he's usually just like gesticulating wildly to some woman who's not age appropriate. Just like, it just is so grody. Hey, can we just...
I think Michael Shannon probably has bad breath too, by the way, but I think I just think that because he just looks like Willem Dafoe, I think.
Like as Agent Van Alden in...
is that Borden, his character in Boardwalk?
Yeah, exactly. So can we start a spinoff podcast speculating at the breath of celebrities?
Sounds like something for disposablemedia.net.
Dude, there is... I am not going to say who it is, but there's a celebrity, somebody that we actually vaguely know, who is in the stratosphere of celebrity right now, who consistently, when I talked to them, had funky breath.
Really?
That's all I'm going to say about
that. Ooh, I think based on your description, I think I have it figured out, but I'll ask
you
later.
Can we agree that champagne of beers is one of the greatest, what would you call it, slogans?
Yeah. And that they stuck with it too. It's great, and I love that they didn't try to sass it up in the 90s or mm-hmm. dance it up in the 2000s. You know, it just is right. What it is.
The High Life, the woman on the High Life bottle is just so iconic and great too. Like that, the slogan, the champagne of beers, has caused me to drink more High Life mm-hmm. than. Like, it's caused me to act on, like, if you're just looking at a bunch of beer, and one of them's called the, excuse me, I had a little champagne before the show. If you're just looking at a bunch of kind of beer, and one of them's called the champagne of beer, I'm going with that one.
And also, there's something about the bottle. It's one of the only, like, clear yes. bottles. It doesn't have a color, you know. It's transparent, not translucent, which is interesting. I don't know if that impacts the beer at all. But honestly, as it's been very clear on the show, given the types of beer that I often drink, like so much of it is about packaging for me too. Like I actually like Miller Lite's packaging quite a bit too, because it's simple, it's consistent. They created a new version of it recently that leans on the old logo, but it's just kind of, it's almost like the old TBTL logo of our faces, like very simplified and removed all the features. They've kind of done that they've turned their can of beer into like an iconic logo. I really, I fall for those trappings.
I consider us the champagne of podcasting.
Ooh, show title. All right, I know you know about TBTL, the podcast. You're listening to it right now, but have you tried TBTL, the newsletter? Because you can. Just go over to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. I gotta say, it's a lot of fun. Every week, Luke and I record a little video that we include in the newsletter. It's called Hey Dummies. We answer your questions, any questions you want to ask us. Well, there's all kinds of things in the newsletter. Don't take my word for it. Here, this is Mary. She's a big fan of the newsletter.
It has a nice welcome introduction, but then you have these phenomenal GIFs that are so much fun. You talk about amazing, wonderful people, and you introduce us to new things. And then the songs of the week. Oh, my gosh. And it just makes me so happy.
It can make you happy, too. I mean, listen, this is coming from Mary. She doesn't even listen to the podcast. She's here just for the newsletter. No joke. So, again, go to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. And we'll try to bring a little extra sunshine to your inbox every Friday afternoon.
Here I go once again with the email. Every week, I hope that it's from a female. Oh, man. It's not from a female.
All right. I know that we actually have
it never even occurred to me that Strong Bad says a female. What were we just talking about?
I asked you about that. I think on air, really? Like maybe a year or two ago, asked you. It was probably when Me Too was really in the news. Is that bad that we're playing that, and at the time you told me you didn't think so, and I don't think I think a few listeners chimed in and said that they weren't offended by it. I mean, I believe he uses that term because it rhymes with email.
Yeah, right.
In fact, it's kind of funny because that was like the idea of like trying to get dates was not part of the Strong Bad verse at all.
Right.
You know what
right,
I mean?
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
that wasn't his thing. He wasn't like a creep. He was a guy typing with boxing gloves, talking to the cheat. But for whatever, I think in that moment, because it rhymes with email, he says female.
Yeah. So anyway, this is from a female, as Strong Bad would say, but not me. This is from listener Megan, who says, hey, thank you for the kettle talk. We were talking about your tea kettle yesterday. You have a fancy designy tea kettle that doesn't whistle, so you almost set the house on fire 2 days ago. I have an old tea kettle from New Hampshire that was a hand-me-down that I don't want to get rid of, even though it's clunky and just not the best option out there. But Megan says, hey, thank you for the kettle talk. I have been having a mental battle with my husband over a designy tea kettle for a couple of years now. I had a perfectly nice red kettle that whistled when it was ready, and I enjoyed it. That sounds cute. That sounds perfect to me.
Yeah.
Megan says, my husband hated the whistle and began waging war on this kettle. When we got engaged, he put this fancy kettle that has a thermometer and a gooseneck on our registry. Quote, we'll be able to make the perfect cup of coffee knowing the exact temperature, he told me. So you make – oh, I see them. They must be using like a French press or something, so they're heating up the water and then making the coffee. We got the new kettle and donated my old one. This new kettle is half the size. It doesn't make a noise. I have also left it on the burner for close to an hour. I never look at that goddamn thermometer. Some things don't need to be designy. They just have to work. I'm very excited for my husband to listen to yesterday's TBTL, your conversations – always spark lively debates. And I would say important debates, Megan, as
absolutely.
Well. These are the things that we're struggling with.
The listener has the exact same tea kettle we do, except I don't think ours has a thermometer built in, but everything else is the same. I know this because yesterday I was Googling around. I was gorgling around trying to find an example of the tea kettle. When you Google like stainless steel gooseneck tea kettle, you get the one we have and the one the listener has, except the version she has the thermometer in it. But it's interesting to know that this is – I guess it probably has to do with the design. Well, I mean the only way a tea kettle can whistle is if the spout has something on it that will have steam pass through it and create a sound, right?
Well, you know how to whistle, don't you? You just heat up the water until it blows. It's a Sartre – it's a Camus quote. Sorry. I was just dropping it in there. You didn't spend enough time alone.
Carter – smarter.
Yes.
By the way, think about, imagine being the first person to figure out a tea kettle whistle. Look at the big brain on that Brad.
That's a really good point.
That's a genius idea to just be like, okay, but how are they going to know when the water's boiling? Well, I don't know. The steam's going to come out. Let's harness that. Let's create a little whistle that will, I mean, that's just such a given now. You don't even think about what a great design idea that was for the first person that did it.
It seems like the type of thing that you would learn later was an accident, right? Somebody like accidentally left a pot on something, and it just made the perfect little opening. When the steam came out, it whistled.
Oh, right.
And then everybody was like, oh, we can make one of those.
I wrote down the war on kettle miss. I was trying to make a war on Chris. You said something about the war on tea kettles. But I also have, by the way, I'm sorry, I'm just hustling us along, but I know that there's a big all staff meeting where once again, I guess find out if we still have jobs. I feel like we would know this week if we were unemployed.
Yeah, this is a
I'm
meeting,
feeling
yeah.
pretty good. Again, shout out to our listeners. Thank you for keeping us, in business as it were. But I also wrote down Champagne of Podcasting as show titles.
I wrote down that as well. I also wrote down Everything But the Joke. And I also wrote down Casper the Friendly Virus. So what do we like the best?
Or what about – I'm assuming that you'll shoot down Scooby-Doo Can Do because it's just a direct ripoff of The Simpsons. You usually don't like that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, and it also doesn't really sing to me in that particular case. Casper, you know Casper the Friendly Virus, we were talking about computer viruses, but maybe this isn't the time to be joking around about viruses.
Yes, I would rule that one out. I wrote down Smartra also. Because you Smartra got Sartre, right? Ha, yeah. There you go.
Okay, maybe we'll do Smartra pants.
Okay, good. All right, that's going to do it for today's show. But don't you worry. We'll be right back here tomorrow with more Imaginary Radio for you. So please do join us for that. Until then, enjoy your Wednesday. Please stay safe. Take care of yourselves. Carefully and mindfully chew your snacks and please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all.
power out.